This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting at KUOW. I thank you for listening. Last night, Bernie Sanders got up at the Democratic National Convention and told his supporters it's time. Time to get behind Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton will make an outstanding president, and I am proud to stand with her tonight.
Everyone knew that call was coming. You expected it. That didn't make it easier for Sanders' most dedicated supporters, though, like Jessa Lewis. She is a Sanders delegate from Seattle. As Bernie addressed the crowd, Jessa stood on the convention floor, arm around a fellow Bernie supporter, and she cried.
We gave. It showed up because our families are hurting, because we're unsure about our future. And because we're fighting for a future that we can't believe in. We believe, like, we need that revolution. We need the party to better represent us.
We reached Jessa Lewis this morning in Philadelphia, and she told me that even though Bernie is not the Democratic nominee, the revolution he started will continue.
For people who are backing Bernie Sanders, it's not purely because we like the guy. It's because he's actually speaking to the needs of the people, and people are hurting right now, and that's why you're seeing such an anti-establishment populist tone in this country.
Last night, Bernie Sanders told you that your work, your support, has produced the most progressive platform in Democratic Party history. You helped make the party more progressive on climate change, health care, minimum wage. Now he said it's time to back Hillary Clinton. Is that enough for you?
Well, as far as the platform goes, you know, we've had to fight for every inch that we can get. And at this point, we're not necessarily confident that the things are going to go in the direction we need them to go. And we're willing to engage in the process in good faith. We're in it. And we're also all dedicated to ensuring that Donald Trump loses. We just need to take some time to take stock and evaluate where we're heading going forward.
Did you boo Bernie Sanders last night?
I did not boo. I did not boo anybody last night.
How about the rest of the Washington State delegation?
You know, the Washington delegation is just a very loud and passionate group. You figure we went 72.7% for Bernie. And the people who are there are the very passionate cream of the crop. And while some individuals, you know, may have spoken out in their passion, the bulk of us are all on board for ensuring the success of the Democratic Party up and down the ticket.
What is your goal now? Is there still work to be done? Do you think there are still concessions to be won in the platform? What's your goal now besides unity and getting people to vote Clinton in November? I assume you're voting for Clinton and are calling for others to do that?
You know, at this point, the bulk of us have not had a chance to figure out what we're going to be doing in November. We are purely pledged, and we're currently, we just voted this morning for Bernie Sanders. Here at the convention, and we're representing people who sent us here in order to do so, to represent Bernie Sanders and to represent a progressive platform. Anything further is going to be, you know, thoroughly thought out and discussed after the convention. But right now, our focus is purely on the work that we've been sent here to do.
So you're not even endorsing Hillary Clinton in November yourself?
I look forward to hearing what she has to say to win us over.
There are Democrats who are saying that if you don't want a Donald Trump presidency, that the time for publicly expressing Hillary Clinton skepticism is over, that that's dangerous because that can dampen, lower the Democratic turnout and hand Trump the presidency. And I hear you still expressing, you're not even saying you're going to vote for Clinton in November. What do you say to that concern?
That it is, that it's not Bernie's job to deliver voters for Clinton. It's Clinton's job to make her case to the American people that she's the strongest candidate.
Well, Bernie Sanders certainly tried to deliver the presidency to Clinton last night and again today.
I understand that. We knew coming into this that this wasn't going to be an easy convention. But we're here because we care, all 43% of us. We are a large percentage of the people who are here, and our voice matters, and we're just trying to add to that discussion.
Well, what is that withholding that you're doing, which, as you say, it's your right. In fact, you could say, your responsibility, given what happened in the Washington State caucuses. What do you want to accomplish with this withholding? Well, we'll wait and see about Hillary Clinton.
I know the Democratic Party stands for more than "we're not Trump." And I want to see that from them. And I guess that's what I'm seeing. Like, I want to see, like, let's get really bold. Let's start addressing these things in such a way that inspires people the way Bernie did. I mean, you think about how many people donated their money when they were unemployed or on fixed income, or knocked on doors and volunteered when they're working multiple jobs, or single parents. I mean, like, that says to me that people were hurting and were ready for someone to speak to them and about them. And I'm a part of the Democratic Party, and I encourage other members of the Democratic Party to come with me in better representing the people of America.
What else is left to accomplish? So the party platform has been written. You've cast your vote for Bernie Sanders, as have many Washington State delegates. What is left to accomplish for you now, besides a possible Clinton vote in November? What? Give me one example of a concrete goal you have now.
Yeah, so what Bernie's campaign is transitioning to is an effort to get progressives elected up and down the ticket across the country. They're going to be endorsing at least 100 people to run for local office starting next year. And between that and supporting other progressives who are currently running for office, like Pramila Jayapal for Congress, our whole focus is going to be shifting to getting progressives elected in every seat up and down the ticket across the country.
This may be Bernie Sanders' last national campaign. We don't know. Who is responsible now for the revolution you want to see?
We are. And that's the thing, is there's a personal responsibility that comes with being a voting American, with being a citizen. And it's about us, and it's this amazing network of people who has come together because we care about this country, because we care about one another, we care about Black Lives Matter. You know, we believe that, yes, this country's great, but we want to see it fulfill its promise and to really step into what it can be. And that's going to take each of us giving of our time and our energy and becoming fully committed and engaged.
Jessa Lewis is a Bernie Sanders delegate from Seattle. KUOW is with her at the Democratic National Convention from Philadelphia. You'll hear our coverage all week. This is KUOW's The Record. Seattle's police chief, Kathleen O'Toole, retaliated against two police officers in the South Precinct. That's according to a King County jury. The decision comes after a trial that included charges of racial bias from both sides. Seattle Times reporter Steve Milicich says the case highlights divisions under the police chief's command. I asked him to explain what sparked the accusations of retaliation in the first place.
Well, what sparked it was a overtime emphasis program in the South Precinct. The precinct was putting a special emphasis on patrolling nightclubs. And from that, some officers were chosen to carry out that assignment, which involved overtime pay. Sergeant Elias in that precinct, who supervised another squad, felt that it was being unfavorably routed to these certain officers to the detriment of other officers, and she began complaining about it.
And there was a racial component to this.
The four officers who were chosen for this emphasis patrol are African American. She is white, and that was part of the dynamic.
The police chief, O'Toole, was accused here. What does she argue she was trying to do?
Well, she argues she was trying to defuse a really difficult situation in the precinct that she viewed as a powder keg. She didn't view it so much as a dispute over the overtime as a battle between warring camps that really threatened to tear apart the precinct. And that was her rationale for transferring Sergeant Elias out of the precinct and then eventually transferring her supervisors out of the precinct when she felt that they weren't taking command of the situation.
The issue of who gets overtime pay is certainly a long way from the police chief's big job of reforming biased policing, which she's there to do, among other things. So what kind of connection, if any, do you think we should make between this ruling of retaliation that's got a racial component and big picture racial reform in Seattle?
Well, it is an unusual situation for the chief to step into, but she arrived here in 2014 with a mandate to carry out reform. And there was a very difficult situation occurring in that precinct. Even Captain Proudfoot acknowledges that as a new chief, it was very difficult for her to step into the situation. So she did intervene to take care of what she thought was a volatile situation. The plaintiffs in this case maintain that she did so expediently because she had been given this mandate to carry out reform and that they were, I guess, the sacrificial lambs. The city maintains that she simply was thrust into a very difficult situation that she inherited and tried to deal with it in a quick and fair way.
Sometimes reform is hard on morale. What do you think this case tells us, if anything, about morale in the Seattle Police Department?
Well, I don't know if you can draw sweeping conclusions. This was a situation somewhat unique to the South Precinct. But whenever there's reform in a department, there's going to be an undercurrent of tension, and whatever problems you have can get swept up into that. And there may have been an element of that here.
Well, meanwhile, we have the police officers union has just rejected this new contract with the city and the police department. How does this decision affect those ongoing negotiations?
Well, the contract vote is another sign of the, unease or perhaps you could even call it some resistance in the department to all the change that's occurring. I don't know if you can draw a sweeping conclusion about how this reflects on the rank and file support for reform. But clearly, you know, this is a difficult time with a lot of change occurring. So this was an opportunity for the Guild to express its sentiments. And in an overwhelming fashion, they sent a message they weren't happy.
Steve Miletich, Seattle Times. Always good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yesterday, a King County jury found Seattle Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole retaliated against Sergeant Ella Elias and Captain David Proudfoot, and the jury awarded them nearly $3 million. The city says it will appeal. I'm Bill Radke with KUOW's The Record, and we're covering the news today, as we always do, police reform, party conventions. But we know that there's more to life than war and politics. For 45 years, NPR correspondent Susan Stamberg has been making sure that the arts live here on public radio. Susan Stamberg visited our studio yesterday, and she told KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman why the arts matter.
There's some therapeutic piece to art, I believe. It's not like going to the shrink. I don't mean it that way. It's that it takes you someplace else. It takes you away from the now and the nitty-gritty and, all the stuff in this world which we live with now, partly because of these communication explosions. And so we're exposed to so much more. But also, it becomes a way to help us deal with those things, with the difficulties, more effectively. After 9/11, I went to... one of the first things I did, really for myself, was go to my favorite gallery in Washington, the Phillips Gallery. I don't know if any of you have been there, but if not, next time you're in D.C., go, because it's fabulous. It's just sensational museum. And I just went there. Yes, I took my tape recorder with me, but I didn't use it. I just went to absorb the beauty of the place and what was on the walls and what artists from other times had done. And then I went back and just wrote an essay about that the difference that standing in the middle of something eternal, which that art is, the art in that museum, not all of it is, but much of it is, the difference that it made to me to be able to go back then with a clearer mind so that then I could face all the aftermath and the residue of 9/11 a little more clearly and not just be burdened with it, not be just so pulled down with it. And I tend to do that quite a bit. And I not just for me, but also I think listeners really need that. I think we all do. There's a huge role that the arts play, and it's why they last. So, we had a winter some years ago. It was the Newt Gingrich Congress, 104th Congress, when government kept shutting down. He kept shutting down the government, and that closed the door on the National Gallery of Art at a time when they were doing an extraordinary Vermeer exhibition. Mm. And I went and talked to people, and people didn't care. They stood online in the snow around the block to get into these doors that were locked. The Dutch, who were lending most of the penny, couldn't believe it, I was told. The embassy reached out to the gallery and said, what are you talking about? Your government can shut down the museum and its people can't get in to see these paintings from our country? They never heard of such a thing. But the people stood waiting for it. And I wrote about that, too. I also interviewed some of those people online. What are you doing here? Don't you know it's closed? And how shocked they were. And I wrote about how those Vermeers, you know, no one remembers who the king or the president or their parliament, whatever form they had in the 1600s when he made those paintings. No one remembers the political problems or the issues of the day. But this many years later, there we stand in the snow online around a corner to see what he was making then. That's what art will do. And that's why I love paying attention to it.
NPR correspondent Susan Stanberg with KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman in front of an audience yesterday at KUOW studio here in Seattle's University District. Concussions and other brain injuries are a big problem for the National Football League. The NFL gave $30 million to the National Institutes of Health for brain research, and now a University of Washington doctor is under investigation for allegedly trying to influence how that money was spent. Dr. Richard Ellenbogen heads up the Department of Neurological Surgery at the UW, and he has a formal connection to the National Football League.
He's the co-chairman of the NFL's Head, Neck, and Spine Committee, which is a group of independent physicians and experts that is basically a policymaking committee for the NFL.
That's Steve Faneroo, senior writer for ESPN. He told KUOW's Kim Malcolm about the allegations against Dr. Ellenbogen. And in the interest of disclosure, I remind you that KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
Dr. Ellenbogen was part of a group of top NFL health officials who were involved in a conference call in which they allegedly tried to pressure the NIH to reverse a $16 million funding decision that went to Boston University. The report said that Dr. Ellenbogen made a separate call in which he reiterated that request. The congressional report concluded that Dr. Ellenbogen had acted inappropriately in the way that he and other NFL officials had tried to influence the process.
And part of that was connected to the fact that he had also competed for that grant, correct?
Right. It came out in the course of our reporting and then was also borne out in the report that Dr. Ellenbogen was listed as a co-investigator on a competing grant application. So in other words, Dr. Ellenbogen was protesting the award to other researchers on behalf of the NFL while he himself had applied for the same grant as an independent investigator. And so the congressional report basically concluded that was inherently in conflict with his role as both a researcher and an advisor to the NFL.
You've written about the high stakes for the University of Washington and for Dr. Ellenbogen as well as a result of this. Talk a little bit about what the University of Washington has at stake here.
One of the things that I think is really interesting is the enormous amount of money that's involved in this situation. UW reported that it received something on the order of $450 million from the NIH in 2015, and something like $4.5 billion over the last 10 years. We've talked to a number of people inside the NIH, and many people there are very angry about this. And so the implications, I think, are clear. You know, this NIH scientific review process is independent, but of course there are human beings that participate in these reviews, and so if there's a perception that the chairman of the neurological surgery department for the university is trying to influence the NIH, the implication is that could have some bearing on future future research funding that the university would be seeking.
And what is Dr. Ellenbogen saying about this?
Well, he's been vehement from the very beginning that he did nothing wrong. And he continues to say that he was acting basically as an American, and he was, he was registering his concerns with the NIH on that basis. I think some people feel like that's a difficult position to take when you're the co-chairman of the NFL's policymaking committee and you're the chairman of the neurological surgery department at a university.
Steve, that's just part of the story with this one researcher at the University of Washington. You've written an entire book about the NFL and the science around concussion. It's called League of Denial. And I'm just wondering, as you've been covering this story over the years, and now you're reporting on Dr. Ellenbogen and the allegations against him, how does this fit into the larger story of the National Football League and concussion research?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, because for years, for a period of two decades, the NFL denied that concussions were really a problem in professional football. They attacked all independent scientists who suggested otherwise, until under pressure from Congress, they basically disbanded the committee that was responsible for that research and started anew. And Dr. Ellenbogen was at the center of that effort to try to bring in highly reputable people who were independent of the league, who could start this whole initiative and start fresh with an issue that has become really a national public health issue. And I think one of the things that is really so surprising to many people is that Dr. Ellenbogen and other people who are on that committee are some of the most reputable neuroscientists in the country. And so to get caught up in an issue where it seems very clear that the NFL was trying on some level to influence the NIH, the federal government scientific review process, I think to many people is really quite surprising. And I think some people are wondering, what really has changed? If the NFL is now moved into a phase where it can try to shape the federal government's efforts around this issue, is the NFL really trying to get to the bottom of the problem, or are they just basically trying to protect their $10 billion business?
ESPN senior writer Steve Faneroo talking with KUOW's Kim Malcolm. We have reached out to Dr. Ellenbogen for comment, haven't gotten a response yet. You're listening to The Record on KUOW.
KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. It's 12:44.
Support for KUOW comes from Third Place Books, announcing the new store in Seward Park, now open. More information at thirdplacebooks.com.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Portland, Oregon. Liberal, quirky, white, and racist? You might associate American racism with the South, but historically, Oregon has been hostile to African Americans.
In 1859, when the state entered the Union, it was the only state that forbade black people from living there. Basically, if you live there and you're black, you had to leave, and if you didn't, you'd be flogged until you left.
Alana Semuels wrote about Oregon's racist history for The Atlantic, and she's not just talking about Eastern Oregon. She says racism is part of Portland's past and present. She gave the recent example of black employees filing a lawsuit against Daimler Trucks in Portland.
They'd find hangman's nooses in their lockers, or the N-word or other words kind of carved onto the walls. So these are African-American employees. So those are very blatant kind of racist things that happen. And then there's kind of a more subtle racism. Black people told me about walking into a restaurant and it suddenly gets quiet. There's discrimination in real estate. So there's a few studies done that showed when minorities applied for apartments, they were charged more or turned down more frequently. And I think there's also just kind of a tone deafness of a lot of people. There's a blog called, for lack of a better word, Stuff White People Say to Black and Brown Folks in PDX, and just, things that people encounter on a daily basis, I think often because there are so many white people and so few minorities that people don't necessarily know how to act and what to say and say things that are really pretty insensitive.
you tick off some numbers, too, about school suspensions and incomes and poverty levels and homeownership. And you also get into something we're familiar with in Seattle, which is black displacement. Will you tell us about that in Portland?
Sure. I mean, from the very early days, black people could only live in certain neighborhoods in Portland. You know, people wouldn't buy or sell or rent houses to them. But every time they kind of settled in a neighborhood starting with near the train station downtown, the city would come in and call the area a slum and say it needed to be kind of redone. And so they'd tear a bunch of stuff down and all the people living there had to move. So this happened a number of times. They were displaced by a hospital. They were displaced by freeways. They were displaced by just a project that wanted to put in kind of different stuff on the ground. And it's happening now. The neighborhood is called Albina, and it used to be kind of abandoned and really derelict, and largely because people weren't allowed to buy homes, and there are a lot of predatory mortgage institutions that came in, knowing that banks wouldn't loan to black people, so they could take advantage of people who were really just desperate to try to own something. And, you know, you see people being displaced even today, and that's also creating racial tensions.
Some of us may know a recent symbol of gentrification, which was Trader Joe's. Will you tell us the story?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really interesting story. Trader Joe's wanted to come in to Albina, which is a historically black neighborhood. And the Portland Development Commission, which has undertook a lot of these urban renewal efforts, gave them a big discount. They said, you know, here's how much you'll have to pay. It was way less than market value if you want to come here. And the Portland African American Leadership Forum, which is a group in the city, said, you know, hold on a second. You're giving this company a big discount, and you haven't really invested in the community. You haven't made sure that African Americans stay. And if this Trader Joe's comes in, it's going to be one more step of things that are going to make this neighborhood more expensive and probably displace people. So they said, you know, if you're going to do this, you really need to think twice about it and make sure that people aren't going to be displaced. And Trader Joe's kind of said, you know, maybe we're not going to come. And this led to a big controversy, you know, people saying, oh, black people don't like Trader Joe's and they're not, you know, they're trying to hold the city hostage. When really what was happening was this group was saying, you know, this has been a long time of displacement, a long time of things coming in and displacing the people who lived here. And maybe it's time to kind of think about the consequences. And I think really the response to the Trader Joe's wanting to come in is the interesting part, because it really signaled to me a tone deafness of the kind of, quote, white progressive population that didn't really understand the history.
I want to talk about this white progressive image. The image a lot of us have of Portland is Portlandia, where quirky liberals are feverishly trying to out-progressive each other. What is the reality, do you think, in Portland?
I mean, I think that can be the reality at the same time that progressive liberals don't understand the history or, you know, think really about the African American or minority population, because as this displacement has happened, a lot of the African Americans have been moved to the far reaches of the city, which does not look like Portlandia. It looks much more kind of urban and industrial. And, you know, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. So, you know, some people told me that they'd try to have meetings about this in the community. And before any of the African Americans could get up to speak, there'd be 60, you know, white people on the list of people who wanted to speak who would come and talk about the environment. So I don't think necessarily all of this is kind of intentional. I think it's just this Portland is a very white place where people bike and, you know, they like the environment. They like to be outside, but they don't necessarily have to think about the people who they've displaced by doing that.
Well, if the racist institutions are history, official redlining is over, official segregation, government-sanctioned segregation is supposedly over, what else could Portland do now?
I mean, I think there is starting to be an awareness that people are being displaced. The city is undertaking this program where when it builds or when it's partners with developers to build affordable housing, people who have been in the neighborhood for a long time, neighborhoods like Albina for a long time, get priority. But I think they could, you know, do a lot more. When I talk to both the city and state about
race and history. No one really wanted to talk to me. No one really had anything to say. And I think maybe by addressing this issue and kind of saying, you know, we know that this happened and we know that it's still a problem and we're really going to be aggressive about combating it, I think that would be a good step to take.
I'm talking with Alana Samuels, staff writer for The Atlantic. We're talking about Portland, Alana, but I'm talking to you from another liberal, majority white city with a past of developing policies favoring basically white supremacy. The history is there. What lesson do you think Seattle takes from your research and your article?
I think one part of it is really acknowledging the history. I mean, I was really shocked, actually, how many emails and notes I got from people who said, I had no idea, you know, I've lived in Portland for a long time, or I've thought about moving to Portland, I had no idea any of this had happened. So I think, you know, making that more of a priority or making that history more accessible. But I think also, you know, as I mentioned, a lot of the minorities in Portland have been displaced to far reaches of the city. And I think having something to bring different races together and kind of just having a dialogue about what's going on that isn't couched in, you know, we're putting in bike lanes and the black people like this and the white people don't, or we're putting in a Trader Joe's and the black people like this and the white people don't. I mean, having a lot more nuanced discussions about development and displacement, I think, is certainly really important. And that's almost always going to be led by whoever's in charge and, you know, whoever's at the top.
Well, there's one idea for dealing with a racist past and present, and it's something we're about to talk about in a moment, which is reparations. And I know you've been thinking about that yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. My colleague Ta-Nehisi Coates has this great cover story for The Atlantic a couple of years ago called The Case for Reparations, kind of saying, you know, this absolutely racist and horrible past has really disadvantaged African Americans for life. I mean, you can't own homes, you can't have jobs. This is going to create generations of poverty, and it's maybe time to do something about that. You know, he goes more into how that exactly would work, and I think it could be difficult, but certainly, you know, making it easier for people who have historically been discriminated against to buy homes or to live in certain neighborhoods or to get certain jobs, you know, that could certainly be a start.
Alana Samuels is a staff writer for The Atlantic. So you just heard us talking about reparations to make up for a history of racial injustice. Well, reparations are happening in Seattle in a small way. A Seattle artist named Natasha Marin was scrolling through Facebook and saw a divide. Her friends of color are angry and frustrated about more police shootings of black men. Her white friends say they want to help but don't know what to do. So Natasha created a page online called Reparations, where friends of color can request something, and white friends can fulfill those requests. Almost immediately, offers and requests started pouring in.
Requests have been as serious as, you know, I need groceries. I don't have a place to live right now. My car is not working. I need a car. I need help with tuition. I need some rent money. So measurable value could be made in somebody's life.
KUOW's Deborah Wong asked Natasha Marin if the project is meant to close the divide she saw among her Facebook friends, why name it something that evokes such a historically divisive topic, reparations?
In the classical sense, reparations does not have to be about a specific historical event. It's really about making something that's broken fixed. And being generous is a great way to fix that feeling in your spirit.
The way you set this up, it's specifically people of color making the requests and people who are identify as white making the offers. Why did you set it up that way? Why make it sort of a racial divide there?
I was just responding to what I had seen, what I was consuming from social media. I feel like a lot of my white-identified friends and allies would like something specific to do so that they can feel less mired in guilt and stagnation, watching videos of brutality against people of color, angry articles, posts. I mean, every single day, it's another story about somebody suffering in some way. There is a discrepancy in the lives of people of color and white-identified people in the United States. For people of color, we'd really appreciate it if our white friends, family members, allies, neighbors would recognize how doable it is to leverage their privilege. Leveraging your privilege doesn't necessarily have to cost you financially. Like, you don't necessarily have to put out money to make a difference in somebody's life. Like, will you listen to me yell and scream for an hour and just vent my anger in a way that's safe? Can you teach me how to sculpt or bead? Can you mentor me? If you're an executive at a company and somebody's looking for a job, your referral, your name drop could make a difference in that person's life.
Are you able to follow up to see whether the people who are making the asks are actually getting responses and forming relationships with people, or whether people are taking the offerings as well? Do you know what's happened as a result of all these postings?
I've had a few people circle back, and it's really exciting to me. There's a gentleman named Quito who needs a service dog. And since his post went up on the website, he's received many donations, and he's, I think, almost halfway to his goal within 48 hours.
You've had a lot of positive response to this, but you are also posting that you've gotten a lot of negative response from trolls and hundreds of emails in your inbox that have just sort of arrived. What are people saying, first of all, and what's your response to that?
I've had trolls invite me to kill myself, hang myself. I've had trolls pretending to be people of color, saying things like, I need money for my three baby daddies. This was hard. It was hard to take in before like 7 a.m. this morning. But I can't say enough positive things about my network. We basically got together and created the Troll Slaying Brigade. So for every negative post, the Troll Slaying Brigade donates a dollar to somebody who has already made a request. So now the trolls are on our side. And the trolls have actually raised more money than had been raised prior.
When you launched this, the idea was that this would be sort of a temporary experiment on social media. Given what's happened, are you still seeing this as something temporary, or could this go on beyond that, beyond what you had imagined?
I think the website could exist beyond the end of the year deadline I set up for the Facebook event page. But it is a lot of administrative work for me. I pretty much do 12-hour days while web building right now. I mean, within 5 days, I'd say at least, not counting trolls, at least 500 people have engaged in terms of either putting in a request or making an offering. And it's just me and my inbox right now trying to field these requests.
This, you call this a social media experiment. What other kind of broader goals do you have for this?
For the most part, I think that we all want the same things. We want to be seen. We want to be remembered well. And we want to add value to humanity. We want to make an impact in some positive way. And this is a really doable way to do that. Just sit and think right now to yourself, what is it that I could offer a stranger? How could I add value to somebody's life? I would like to see the people in my community happier. That would be a success.
Natasha Marin is a Seattle-based artist and the founder of the Reparations Project.